This is the Future of HR Podcast, episode 150.
From our perspective, what you're really trying to do is look for investment opportunities in talent. If it was your money, or if it was grandma's retirement funds, where would you invest in talent? What critical bets would you make? And you would probably make bets in talent, parts of the workforce where you could make a difference. Again, that's that eight-year-old variability. So you're looking for variance, but you're also looking for opportunity or strategic impact. So just because all jobs are important, but not all jobs are strategic. So I'm looking for those jobs where if I could increase the quality of talent in that role by 10 or 15 or 20%, big bells would ring from the perspective of the customer. It's got to hit our strategic capabilities, whether it's innovation or whatever it is, and we have to have an opportunity. Another way of saying that is that variance provides the opportunity and strategic impact provides the context.
How can differentiating talent result in real business impact? Why is asking the right questions in workforce analytics so critical? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR Podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career to the next level. If you're really serious about becoming a more business-focused and strategic HR leader, then you need to make attending my Next Gen HR Accelerator program a part of your 2025 development plan. And if you're a CHRO who wants your HR team to have even more influence and business impact, then you're going to want to send your team to my Next Gen HR Accelerator program as well. Because my Next Gen HR Accelerator program is a best-in-class leadership development program specifically designed to equip high-potential HR talent with the skills, mindset, and tools they need to become strategic business leaders and value creators. Over four intensive weeks, you'll build your business acumen and financial acumen. You'll sharpen your strategic thinking, elevate your executive influence and communication skills, and learn how to translate business strategy to HR initiatives that deliver impact and value. You also get targeted feedback and coaching to help you grow as a leader. As every NextGen HR Accelerator participant receives 360 feedback, personal coaching from me, and leaves with a targeted from-to development plan. That is why one past participant said the NextGen HR Accelerator program completely transformed their approach to HR. Over the past year, over 100 HR leaders have been through the program from companies like Verizon, McDonald's, Nike, Prudential, Pacific Life, Hershey, Kohler, and many more. Our next cohort starts September 9th and registration is now open. Space is limited and we expect to sell out. To learn more about the Next Gen HR Accelerator program, go to futureofhr.com or reach out to me directly to learn more. And with that, my guest this week is Mark Huselet. Mark is a distinguished professor of workforce analytics, chair of the International Business and Strategy Group, and director for the Center for Workforce Analytics at Northeastern University. His focus is on building measurement systems that show how workforce, HR, and people management drive business success. Mark has co-authored three books, and his most recent, Workforce Analytics, A Global Perspective, is a must-read if you are a people analytics or talent leader. Mark and I also got the chance to discuss another one of his books, The Differentiated Workforce, which I believe is one of the top five most important books ever written on the topic of talent management. Mark's a fellow of the National Academy of Human Resources, the Society for Industrial and Organizational Psychology, and the Association for Psychological Science. His research has received numerous awards, and he's a frequent speaker to professional and academic audiences on the topics of HR measurement and HR strategy, and he's consulted with dozens of companies around the world. It was such a pleasure to spend time with and learn from Mark as we discussed why most companies do not treat people data as rigorously as financial data and why they should, the evolution from critical roles to strategic work and why success now depends on pinpointing the specific work not just the job titles that drive results. Why most organizations overinvest in senior leaders and underinvest in developing early and middle career talent. How HR and people analytics teams can bridge the gap with business leaders to ask better questions, not just provide more data. And why AI and workplace data will offer powerful insights, but also introduce risks like bias and outdated assumptions, and much, much more. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode as you listen, so drop me a line on LinkedIn and say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Mark. Mark, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
JP, I'm doing just great, and I'm thrilled to be here. Honored and delighted.
Well, I'm excited to have you here as well. I have been following your work, your books, your research for a long time. So when I saw you have another book coming out, I was like, oh my gosh, opportunity to reach out to Mark and maybe he'll come on the podcast. And here you are.
You're most kind.
Mark, you've been studying workforce analytics for decades now. And when you look at where we are today versus where we were 20 years ago, what's changed and what hasn't changed?
Wow, that's a great question, JP, and it's a really thoughtful question. And if you think about it, or at least as I try to get my arms around this topic, and you're right, I've been doing this for a long time, which is another way of saying I don't have any other ideas. I really have focused on workforce analytics and trying to understand how talent makes a difference in organization for 40 years, in my whole professional life. If you think about that, obviously, we can talk, and I'm sure we will talk about what's new and talk about AI and talk about the developments and just the flood of information around talent and the importance of talent and business success that everybody seems to be interested in. But really, from my perspective, this issue of workforce analytics is very old. We've found some citations. In fact, in writing this most recent book, we found some workforce analytics from folks who are putting together the pyramids, who are trying to understand and building talent profiles and figuring out how do we build a book of business around who, what, when, where, and how for talent to build ships and those kinds of things. Obviously, thousands of years ago in the Middle Ages, and then certainly through the Industrial Revolution, talent became really the source of wealth creation in many organizations. So talent is, and talent analytics are really very old. So the idea that we need to know how many people work here, what do they cost, who's coming, who's going, why, who are our good leaders, who are our bad leaders, how do we make decisions about hiring, development, pay, those kinds of things. Those are evergreen issues. What's new, and I think what's really different, I think probably cuts to the core of your question, is that we really haven't been able to answer them very effectively, which is the problem, right? Starting 20, 25 years ago, 30 years ago, perhaps, the academic literature and the professional literature, and people like you and me who work in organizations as well as have an interest in the academic side of this enterprise, started to really say, well, how do we really get our arms around that? And how do we begin to measure that? And so for most organizations, most businesses in Western economies spend 70 to 75% of their total spend on talent, wages, benefits, administration, training, as well as the HR function and all of that. And yet the accounting systems that we use today are roughly 300 years old conceptually. They're really built around physical assets. So where's our truck? Where's our building? How do we expect this? If a truck goes missing in a business, we probably have a pretty good idea that that's gone and it's a problem. But if someone who's a top talent in our organization leaves, first of all, we might not even know that she leaves. We might not know why. And we might not, most importantly, know what we could or should have done about it. So that's a real problem, is that we have an accounting infrastructure that's designed for physical assets and problems that are built around talent-related assets. That's been part of the core of the shift over the last 20 years to really begin to think about and to instrument, to begin to build measurement systems around talent. When you go in, you figure out, well, all right, we spend 70% of our spend on the workforce, we ought to understand that a little bit. We ought to have performance appraisals on everyone. Well, turns out we don't. We ought to know how the pay distributions roll out in the organizations. Turns out we typically don't. Obviously, you and your audience know that quite well. The infrastructure isn't there. The question is, how do we build it? And then how do we focus on the things that matter? And then most importantly, how do we begin to tie strategy? What are our business outcomes? What are the objectives? Who are our best customers? How do we help them win? And then at the core, how does talent make a difference? And then how do we build a measurement system around that? This is a problem when you ask an academic a question, you're going to get a very long-winded answer.
I love it. No, it's so interesting because I had not heard about the pyramids and gone that far back. What I had really heard or read, and again, I'm not sure where I remember this from, but it was really around Napoleon, and he was building a strategic workforce plan that was one of the ones that got more popularized. It makes a lot of sense that, of course, since the beginning of time, we've tried to figure out, well, who can help us do this? Who's got the right skills and capabilities? Maybe we use different words back then, but that is something that's evergreen that won't go away because it changes with the context and the business changes. And so we have to change the capabilities we need. What may be changing today is that with AI and really almost everything being digital, especially around knowledge workers, a lot of digital exhaust and that we're putting off, whether it's my Teams messages, Slack, email, what I'm producing. Now, I don't know if we know what's pseudo productivity and what's actual value added there, but there's a lot more information about individuals today that we have. So is AI going to help us start to get closer to answering who is that top performer? Why did they leave? And what's the business cost? And not in non-GAAP terms, but in true measuring true intellectual capital.
Yeah, boy, JP, that's another great question. And when you ask somebody like me that, I get very antsy and you think, well, the obvious answer is yes, of course. And why? Well, because we're beginning to instrument the problems that we've had for a long time, but couldn't get our arms around. So we can ask different questions and get answers potentially to questions that we had before. And my colleague, Nada Sanders at Northeastern, she's a brilliant scholar, works in marketing analytics, and they have many of the same challenges, problems that we have. And she basically makes the point is that we can answer questions we've always had, some of the things we talked about. We can ask new questions that we didn't even know we had. And perhaps most importantly, we can capture and capitalize on the naturally occurring field experiments that are happening everywhere in our organization. In California, we do it this way. In New York, we do it this way. In Belgium, we're doing it that way. Whatever it is, a training system, a new product rollout, a new performance management system, they're happening simultaneously. Let's capture the marginal effects on each one of those. It's free research, right? All we have to do is observe. So those are great things. And obviously, generative AI is, you can't walk down the street without getting a lecture from somebody on that. And that's certainly the case. However, and this is a big however, given the lecture I just gave you on the data problems that are endemic for what we have, here's the problem that we have. If we build a model that's based on incomplete data or racist data or sexist data, and then repeat that, we're going to get to an end we don't want to be at an accelerated rate. So, for example, I know you know this better than me, conventional IO psychology is built on competency models. We identify high and low performers. We build a competency model. We link that to behaviors and outcomes. We figure out what differentiates high and low performers. We build a selection system based on that. I mean, this is IO psychology 101, right? Yes, we can potentially do that with regression-based or other forms of AI-based systems. But what if our data is wrong? What if our data are incomplete? What if the reason that the people that are successful are not the reasons that we want them to be there? Or more importantly, what if the future doesn't look like the past? What if we need a team-based, collaborative, innovative structure, and the old school was something else, right? And we turn these AI models loose on that, then we've doubled down on a model that is really going to be disastrous for us. And the problem with the AI solutions is that you don't observe the coefficients. You don't know why. You just see an answer. And you say, well, it's AI. It's got to be right. That's the challenge. In the olden days, in the 80s, when we would get hauled into court for an EEOC violation or something like that, you had to justify how you collected the data, whether the coefficients were biased, validity of the selection systems, all that stuff. And I don't see that now.
Yeah, you can't show your work.
You can't show your work. So that's what makes me really concerned, is that the AI models will generate an answer, but we have to push hard to say based on what.
Yeah, it's really insightful, because you're right. A lot of the models would be based on past behavior, past predictions, past data, which may not produce what you want in the future. And I think that data accuracy, I mean, if you think about any technology we're using, if even it wasn't AI, if it was any kind of model, the data is so important, right? If you have bad data, it's going to have a bad outcome. And so I think that's where every organization really has to start. The other piece about AI, I mean, again, I liked your reference. We all get lectured every day in the street about AI because, yes, everyone's screaming and shouting they're AI experts when really no one is at this point because it's so new. But it is really designed to come up with new ideas. I've had some past guests that talked about this, that the hallucination is not a bug. It's actually the feature. That is actually what it's designed to do. And that's actually now we're trying to make it be automated and standard. And you're like, go do the same prompt three times on ChatGPT and you'll get three different answers likely. And that is what makes it interesting. So I do think you're making some great points about we've got to be really thoughtful about the data and how we set it up. But how do you think about that idea of the hallucinations? And are we using this is it the wrong tool for this? And we should be thinking about AI in a different way, maybe.
Is AI or instrumented learning in general, is it a tool for going faster? Doing what you know how to do well faster. So for example, if we're FedEx or Costco and we're trying to optimize the distribution and logistics systems for delivering packages, and why does Amazon deliver me packages at 3 o'clock in the morning? I don't want them delivering me packages at 3 o'clock in the morning. However, they have a distribution and logistic model that says in Mark's neighborhood, the load is the least there and I can fill a full truck when the streets are empty and I can base, it's cheaper for us to do that. That's a solution. While I might not love it, it's neutral in that people's lives aren't affected. Nobody's getting fired because of that. And the same thing in financial models, in various, lots of different parts of the business that are value free. That's not our game. It's about talent and people. And when you're making decisions about who gets hired and who gets fired, it's a very different standard, both ethically and socially and frankly, legally, about making sure that we do it right. Because I worry very much about automation of, as I mentioned, these problems. And I'll tell you, we can talk a little bit more and slow me down if I'm being annoying here, but I do a lot of coaching, consulting with organizations around measurement and analytics. And one of the things that is happening in our sport in analytics is because talent is relatively so important, and we have new disciplines like data science and so on, everybody's getting into the act. And by everybody, I mean we have degrees, master's, undergraduate in data science and analytics. Virtually every vertical in business, finance, operations, marketing, and so on, has dedicated analytics programs at most major universities. When you look at the teams of people that are actually doing this in organizations, 20 or 30 years ago, it would be people like us that were trained in IO psychology, that knew about item response theory, that knew about measurement, that knew about scales and validations. Now we've got incredibly bright people that are trained in economics and statistics and supply chain and change management, all very, very important things, but they're not measurement. you have sometimes folks that get involved in making decisions and using data that once you have a conversation with them about, this might be a challenge and let's walk through why that is, they say, well, of course, but they don't bring that to the table because entry bar into the sport was not training and measurement, tests and measurement. So I worry about that.
Yeah, well, I think to your point, more and more people have the capability with AI to do analytics. I mean, you can drop in an Excel sheet and ask for it to do things. If you don't know how to use something in Excel, you can ask, hey, how do I do this kind of analysis? You could probably vibe code a website that does what you want. But to your point, especially around talent and people, there's a piece of ethics. There's a value to that we have to think through, an ethos that we have as HR leaders and people analytics leaders to do the right thing and make good decisions, because AI ethics will become a bigger and bigger issue, I think, for us. So you're making some great points there. But we're not going to spend the entire conversation talking about AI. I'm not going to let us do that, Mark, because that's what every other conversation is about. And we don't get to talk to you very often. So your latest book, Workforce Analytics, A Global Perspective, is a collection of articles by people analytics thought leaders. And it looks super comprehensive. Like, I cannot wait to read this. I know I'm geeky enough to want to read the whole book. But I'm curious, are there one or two ideas from the book that just really changed how you were thinking about a topic?
In the short story, this particular manuscript is, it took us 5 years to write. And mostly that was my fault. I own that for a lot of different reasons. I kept learning more and wanting to change things, which is the kiss of death for any author. But my co-authors, Martin Edwards, an Australian academic, phenomenal guy, done a lot of different work in analytics. Dana Minbeva, who is, I'm sure you know, IO psychologist, incredibly gifted European, probably the thought leader in workforce analytics in Europe. And Alec Levinson, who's another incredibly capable American guy who works at USC in the Center for Effective Organizations. And we've been friends and been working on this for many, many years. And we started writing this book and said, we need to have a global focus. We need to really think this through. And so we've all got these different experiences. And we started doing these calls. It became like group therapy, because right when we got this contract and started writing, it was really around the beginning of the pandemic. The world was changing very quickly. Our lives were changing. Everything, classes were online. So we really started talking about, what's the problem we're trying to solve? Well, we have to help leaders and managers build evidence-based ethical systems to help manage and measure the contribution of the workforce to business success. That's what we want to do. Well, why can't they do that? Well, we kind of went back and forth. And we said, collectively, we think that there's a process here. And there's four pieces to this process. And probably the most important thing is that in analytics, you have to ask the right question. Each of us had been working in organizations where leaders and managers say, I just need to know more about the workforce. I don't have any time to collect data. Don't distract me. Take the data you have, work with what you got, and then we'll go from there. So the problem is that then the data that you have becomes the questions that you're going to answer. And it takes you down the wrong street, or it can take you down the wrong street. We said any good social scientist starts with reading some things about the literature, understanding your business, and back to the, how does talent help us win or not? We said, got to ask the right question. Then you've got to collect the right data. And you can't start with the assumption that the data you have is the data that you need. Is it about performance management? Is it about time to fill? Is it about time to capability? Well, it could be any of a million different things. But the point is, the data drives, it comes from, is a derived demand from the question. So ask the right question, collect the right data, then analyze the data correctly. So this is the stats part. And ironically, we all kind of raised our hand at the same time and said, that's easy stuff. Maybe because we're all trained. This is statisticians. But frankly, the quantitative part of workforce analytics, in my view, is the easy part. That's the part you can outsource. That's the part in other parts of the organization where you can get some help from finance or accounting, other kinds of, there's always somebody who can run a regression on the team somewhere. There's not always somebody on the team that knows your business well enough to ask insightful talent-related questions. And then the last part, and I know you have, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about this, is you've got to influence the right decision. Having the most thoughtful, insightful questions and the right data and the right analyses don't get you anywhere unless you can influence people who need to be influenced. You can persuade, teach, learn, and help to grow and hold accountable. That's the model that this book is written around. Once we got that, we had clarity around that, we said, well, we can write most of this stuff, but there's parts of this story, especially around leading edge AI and leading edge econometrics, where we might not have the examples that we need. And so we brought in other people. But the four of us built the framework and then brought in other people to really help us learn and to build. That's a long-winded answer to
That was great. It's great context on the book. And it starts with asking great questions. You talked about knowing the business. Now, I'm not sure everyone always has someone around to do a regression analysis. My listeners might think differently, but I mean, yeah, I may know a few people to call. But HR leaders, a lot of times, we do need people analytics to help us figure this out. But HR business partners, potentially, or the talent leaders, may be a little bit closer to what's happening in the business to start asking those questions. How do you see people analytics and HR business partners need to come together to ask the right questions to frame this up? Because I think it's an important partnership, but how do you see that happening in real life?
Yeah, at the root of certainly my own passion is how do you talent and both analytics, or economists call it derived demand, so that if talent matters, analytics matter. If talent doesn't matter in your business, then analytics probably aren't going to help you very much. So it's really around understanding variance, understanding variability. To do that, you have to start to ask, what are the attributes of our product? You have to think like a strategist. Who are our customers? Not just all of our customers, but who are our high margin customers? What is she looking for from us, both now and in the future? What are the organizational capabilities that we have that build that product to allow us to charge excess rents for and to satisfy our high potential clients? And then what is the work? And then what is the workforce that helps us get there? So that's the causal logic. So you don't start with what data do we have? You say, again, what's the problem we're trying to solve and how does talent make a difference? And I'll give you a quick example there. Historically, and you're very kind in mentioning the Differentiated Workforce book, the essence of that book and the story of my life here is that organizations, when they invest in talent, typically invest at the top of the house where people are already very good at what they do. Yeah. So the example that I use is that many of your listeners and certainly myself have maybe coached kids, and maybe it was swimming or soccer or guitar, or whatever it is. When you think of someone who is an Olympic level diver or a great musician, how much energy and what does it take to get her to improve her performance by 20%? It's almost impossible. But think of that 8-year-old running around in the soccer pitch, right? You just want to get them running in the same direction, right? That's the start. And so you think of from the beginning of the season to the end of the season, the improvement in talent is very dramatic as a result of maturation and coaching. So measurement and influence had a big effect on the outcome because there was variance in the population that you capitalize on. Well, what do organizations do? Well, we spend a ton of money sending our senior executives who are already gone through all of these gates of promotion to executive ed. And now, I don't want this to be come across as Huseland says, no one executive shouldn't be trained. That's not the point. But have we ignored the variance in those entry-level project managers or the accountant one? We may have thousands of these folks running around, and the gap from the top to the bottom might be enormous. Might that not be a better investment of marginal resources than trying to basically bring coals to Newcastle to treat people who are already really, really very good? So that would be an example of trying to understand how variability in how good people are lines up against the capabilities we're trying to build, whether it's innovation or speed to market or zero defects or whatever it is that drives our business. How does that variance in the workforce end up being reflected in products?
And to double click, and this is something I'm very passionate about because I've actually kind of left HR and talent space in terms of being internal and gone on my own. And so my entire mission is helping to develop next gen HR leaders. And I've got programs that focuses on director level because it's such a gap. When you get to a VP level, it's not that we shouldn't bet and help develop VPs to get to CHROs. It's just that most of those programs are already picked the horses that are going to win the race either way. It's sort of like, well, they're going to get there with or without you, to be honest. But there's all this other amazing HR directors, especially what I see in HR, is that we have flattened organizations. So people are now expected to operate at a higher level, but we're not investing to help them get there. And if you think about building a pipeline, to your point in these variants, so let's just say we have 1,000 or so, maybe new graduates or entry-level roles coming in, 20-25% of those folks probably have potential to move up and grow in the organization. And the more we can help them improve that variance, the faster the organization has a pipeline, strong pipeline of talent. So I think that's what I'm hearing you say. Not everyone's going to be able to go that fast, but if we think about investing in some of the best at that level, they'll go faster. That variance and that performance will improve quicker than others, and the organization will reap the benefit of it.
Absolutely. And think about how much easier it is at each step of the gate if you can pre-select people and have, based, frankly, the low performers are not in the population to move ahead. For whatever reason, you've coached them, you've helped them. Reduce the variance as soon as you can in the process model, because you're going to have to deal with it eventually. So deal with it soon, and people will be grateful. I mean, I can't tell you how many times obviously I work in the university, so I spend a lot of time around young people that are coaching and helping them and trying to think about their careers. And they'll tell me, the organization's, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I don't know. I'm not getting any feedback. I don't know where to go. I don't know if I'm doing great or not. That's not a helpful situation. They certainly don't appreciate it.
No, I know we want to invest. And thinking about investing in HR, or really, I would say the HR function in general, when you think about functions like finance or marketing, analytics is a little core to what they do a lot of times, whether it's analyzing financial reports or analytical marketing data. But HR often lacks that foundational training in measurement and workforce analytics. How do you suggest HR leaders close that gap? And for CHROs in general, how do you think your HR team can step up and do that better?
That's a great question. And it's a challenge because I'm thinking through how analytics teams get staffed in my experience. And typically, in my experience, there's a recognition that we need a team to do this. It's going to take a village. It's going to take different capabilities in different parts of the organization. And also, for many of the things that we need to have done, it's not a full-time job. So we end up having cross-functional teams, temp teams. I might have three people from marketing, someone from finance, in part because the nature of the problem in analytics is that I need data from finance, I need data from marketing, I need data from HR, I need somebody from all these teams to get together. So then the challenge is, who's going to drive the bus and who's going to help us really think through what needs to happen and sequence the operations? That's where you've got to make sure that people can do what they're very good at, but also know what the adjacencies are. I need to understand that, JP, you've got to spend extra time on scale development because having reliable measures of pay satisfaction is key to our kind of moving forward. Now, I don't need to be that type of analyst, but I need to understand and appreciate what you're doing. So we have to kind of spend some time in messy meetings and coach each other through the process.
Yeah, that's really helpful. And I'll give you a little bit deeper dive in this. I'm just curious, Mark, your perspective. Here's what I see happening in organizations. The people analytics team, they obviously know how to do this. They build either a Tableau or a BI dashboard. Maybe it's a vendor I won't mention, or whoever, they're doing great work. And there's some AI tools now that are actually helping them pull that data out. So it's not that we can't find the data. It then becomes, how do we sort of tell that story, to your point, or how do we actually influence executives or be relevant with that data that solves a business problem. And that's the bigger challenge. It's not getting the data, because I think organizations, especially bigger ones, have gotten better at that. Small organizations, I'm sure it's still challenging. But when you think about the take that information and then translate it to something meaningful for executive, any other thoughts there on how to upskill your teams?
A lot of change management professionals will tell you that executives, especially senior executives, are very story-driven and basically are persuaded not by your regression equations, but rather stories of how changes in behavior lead to change in outcomes they care about. So the first issue is that you really have to understand what these executives, what's on their plate. They've got a million things going on. They're catching fastballs all day long, but some of the problems are bigger than others. And of those talent-related problems, what is it that they're trying to do, even though they might not articulate it the way that we might? They'll say, look, I just don't have the talent I need, or I just can't get that team to do this. Or they'll use broad statements, but as an HR person, you can pick it apart. And that's because X, Y, and Z. So I would say, to manage the influence in the change management process, we have to give away sometimes of the verbiage that we use and understand the language that they use and understand how they understand the world. That means maybe you have to shadow them. Maybe you have to have somebody close to them, talk to them about what their issues are, test, pre-run, figure out what's been successful and what's not. Pilot projects are great, but you can't assume that the deck of 50 slides that I might roll in with is going to be successful, because you're going to get 3 slides in and they're going to throw you out, or they're going to take this, they're going to work on whatever it was in the last meeting. So you have to, in a sense, pitch the meeting from the user's perspective and not ours.
Yeah, I think a really important point to talk about: how do you frame the conversation in a language and a business problem that matters for that business leader is so critical. Otherwise, they're going, I think you're right, they're going to move on and it's just not going to really land like you hope. So 50 slides is not your answer. It's probably 3 really impactful slides that hit that topic, or having just a conversation with some data as backup if they want to go there. Let's talk about differentiated workforce, because as I said to you in kind of our prep, I think it's one of the top 5 talent management books that people should read. Differentiated Workforce had a huge impact on me. I think it came out in 2009. Which feels like a long time ago, yet this is an evergreen topic. Almost all of the work today, when people hear critical roles and segmenting talent, comes from this book and your research with you and other authors that worked on this. So I'd love to know, as we talk about managing talent like an investment portfolio and identifying these roles by their strategic importance, how has your thinking evolved since you wrote that book and you and the other co-authors came up with that concept?
You're very kind, and I'm honored that you found it helpful. That's why we do what we do. But my co-authors, Brian Becker and Dick Beatty, friends, colleagues, co-authors for many years, along with Dave Ulrich, who we wrote a couple of other earlier books, HR Scorecard and the Workforce Scorecard. That book was really a build. You can see the line of thinking through those 3 manuscripts that got to differentiation. So that book was really more about how to manage that portfolio as opposed to the measurement stuff, although it's in there. Basically, the essence of that story was, in the olden days, in the 80s or the 90s, quote-unquote, great HR management was doing the same thing for everyone the same way. And we used to have things like HR audits. Does everybody get 40 hours of training? Does everybody get the same everything? By level, obviously, you manage the executives differently than mid-level and entry-level folks. The story of that book was really around, you need to segment the workforce just as you might a products or other parts of the portfolio, both globally and by level and by region. And that's where we got to that point. The notion of a strategic position was something we'd work with clients for 20 something years. And so we had lots of experience getting that done. What does that mean? Well, it means that from our perspective, what you're really trying to do is look for investment opportunities in talent. If it was your money, or if it was grandma's retirement funds, where would you invest in talent? What critical bets would you make? And you would probably make bets in town, parts of the workforce where you could make a difference. Again, that's that eight-year-old variability. So you're looking for variance, but you're also looking for opportunity or strategic impact. So just because all jobs are important, but not all jobs are strategic. So I'm looking for those jobs where if I could increase the quality of talent in that role by 10 or 15 or 20%, big bells would ring from the perspective of the customer. It's got to hit our strategic capabilities, whether it's innovation or whatever it is, and we have to have an opportunity. Another way of saying that is that variance provides the opportunity and strategic impact provides the context. For us, that's a small group of roles. There may be the most roles we've ever found, and we've done hundreds of these, is maybe six or seven roles in an entire organization. Now, there may be lots of employees in roles, but six or seven roles. And they can be at any level. They tend to be relatively low in the organization. And they tend to not be on senior executives' radar, because if they were, there wouldn't be any variance. They'd have already solved the problem. That's kind of the story of the differentiated workforce. Well, what's changed? I think what's really changed now, and this other book that we're almost done with, is really around strategic work. It's one thing to talk about strategic positions, but within positions, you're seeing a lot of variance in what people do. So we've had project managers forever. We've had supply chain engineers forever. But the actual day-to-day job has changed. Well, obviously, in the pandemic, all bets were off, right? Everything changed. And that really made us think pretty carefully about the level of analysis is not the job, it's work. And that's harder because you have to have an even finer pencil to find that work, to figure out what's the work that is going to drive the new products for new customers and so on. But it's exciting, and I'm glad it's hard. Because if it was easy, everybody would do it and I'd be out of business.
Yeah, we all would be out of business a little bit, even our HR friends, everyone listening. And you mentioned maybe the six or seven roles are really, truly strategic in an organization. And this is not going to come as a shock to you, Mark, but that is not how it's being used today. What you find is a little bit of the peanut butter spread. Every function has to have some critical or strategic roles. And Mark Efron and the Talent Strategy Group just did a survey on this. So I'll defer to that company and go to Mark and the Talent Strategy Group to read that latest research. But what I have seen is that especially support functions have a hard time knowing and feeling like, gosh, I'm not strategic. Well, yeah, you're critical. You're requisite. These are important roles, as you mentioned, but you're not revenue driving. And so the way I've always thought about this, really from your work and I think in my own experience, is that we're really measuring and looking at what are revenue drivers, like who's actually impacting revenue in these roles that actually has an opportunity to impact the work they do, can impact customers or revenue growth. Secondarily, can they impact like a bad hiring decision? Could they make a really bad impact on your organization long-term because they have a budget or have a position that could have an impact on the customer that way? The third, which I don't use very often, is they're really hard to recruit. That to me is lazy. That's not a measurement of strategic roles where I come from or how I think about it. It's a factor in maybe workforce planning. But I'd love for you to critique what I just said there. I'm sure I missed a few things, but that is how I thought about revenue and the idea of impacting cost.
I've come to use over time A, B, and C players for A, B, and C customers in A, B, and C positions. And what does that mean? Some jobs and some work keep you from losing. Some roles around quality or inspection or maybe supply chain. But having top talent in the planet in those roles isn't going to differentiate you. But you can't fall below the 70th percentile, 60, whatever it is. Some jobs, we call them B jobs or B work, the returns are linear. Where more is better, where it really is the case that simply adding better and better talent is a good. But the jobs that I'm interested in, the work that I'm interested in, has increasing returns to scale. Anybody who is a sports fan, when there's recruiting, they say, we have to have this cornerback or this whatever it is. Doesn't matter what it costs, we have to have him or her to win. And those are the jobs that are strategic, where you might have seen right now, sorry to bring us back to AI, where there's a bloodbath for talent in AI. And so the compensation is absolutely enormous. Signing bonuses of $100 million for some people. Even if it's a paltry $50 million, what does that say about our valuation there? But back to your point about revenue generation and so on, it's possible. But the jobs and the work that I'm most interested in, I think, are the roles that indirectly affect those outcomes. So if you think of a salesperson, obviously there's a linear, unless we're selling Ozempic or something where we're just literally taking orders, where the market defines, or Rolex watches, where there's a constraint on the product, where sales behavior really does drive the outcome. That's almost a one-to-one model. That those models are well understood. But how does product development or packaging or customer insight or all of those things that don't have a direct effect on revenue, but have an indirect effect through product placement and those kinds of things, those become very interesting, because long-term, what economists call economic rents, are possible because they fly below the radar. And I can get the best person in the world in that role and hang on to her because nobody, it's unobserved. Nobody else knows that that has such a big effect for us. The smart companies I'm working with are spending money on roles. And you say, well, why would they do that? Well, because they really understand how that works. So I don't know if I've answered your question, but...
No, I think that makes sense. Your idea of the A role, B role, C role, and players makes sense. And what I heard you saying, just to summarize, the A is really digging in to understand at a deeper level those individuals doing the work that really aligns to the capabilities that really drive value, not the ones that are easy to get to, which requires probably some analytics, some good measurement, and inquisitive leadership team who really wants the capabilities for the long term. So that's excellent.
And you're not going to do it in an afternoon. It takes time. It's not something that we're going to have a 90-minute meeting to identify our strategic positions. And you say, yeah, I can't help you with that one.
Yeah, if it was that easy, we'd all do it. And I think that's why it has not happened at scale that we'd like to see. Mark, last question for you. I ask this to all my guests. What is one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
I would say intelligence, workforce intelligence, talent-related intelligence, understanding how, again, the workforce makes a difference. Because to me, workforce analytics has two pieces to it. It really is levels in relationships. First of all, how many do we have, at what cost, and where are they? But that doesn't tell us how to get more and why they leave and what to do next. So the levels question is a necessary but not sufficient condition for really kind of intelligence and knowledge and managing change. I need to know what to do next. I don't need to just know how deep the water is.
Mark, this was a great conversation. We covered a lot of ground. Thanks so much for being on the part of the podcast. Thank you for sharing more about Differentiate Workforce. I got to geek out. I know that was really just for me. But this was awesome. And thanks again for just being part of the community.
Well, JP, thanks for all you do. Your body of work is really impressive. It's really great that you're able to bring us all together. So thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR Podcast. Thanks again to Mark for his ongoing contributions to the field of workforce analytics and for his insights on the role talent plays in business outcomes. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. We'll be back next week with another amazing guest, Aseel Omar, who is the Chief Equity Officer and VP of Employee Experience for AbbVie. In my conversation with Aseel, we discussed her career journey, why equity is more important than ever, and why HR leaders need to be focused on transforming the employee experience. This is a great conversation and one you will not want to miss. Thanks again for being part of the Future of HR community.